You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Catherine Smith.
The Renegade Star Series, books 1-3 by J.N. Cheney. Jace Hughes is a renegade. That means taking almost any job that comes his way, no matter the situation. So long as he can keep his ship floating, he's free to live the life he wants. But that all changes when he meets Abigail Pryor, a nun looking for safe passage out of the system. Too bad there's something off about the cargo she's carrying. Jace knows he shouldn't ask too many questions, but when odd sounds start coming from inside the large metal box, he can't help but check it out. Big mistake. The Renegade Star box set includes the first three books in the series, 900 plus pages, 300 five-star reviews and counting. Find out why people are so intrigued by this thrilling science fiction epic. You won't believe the twists and turns this series takes, or the secrets that get revealed. The Renegade Star series by J.N. Cheney. Devin Ford, Recon, the expansion series, book 1. Hundreds of years in Earth's future sees the United Global Territories striving to colonize the Moon and Mars. The discovery of a clean energy source ended the world's reliance on fossil fuels overnight, and years after the resulting wars, a new discovery puts the tenuous world peace at risk, that of faster-than-light travel. With humanity on the verge of traveling to new solar systems and all the humanitarian and scientific possibilities involved, a discovery by the reconnaissance team turns everything upside down. Join the small team of the reconnaissance mission who fight friend and foe to complete their mission objectives, no matter where it leads them or what the personal cost. Devin Ford, Recon, the expansion series, book 1. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Catherine Smyth on the show with me today. She has a fantastic new book called All the Lives We Ever Lived, Seeking Solace in Virginia Woolf. This book is an incredible read. I think you guys are really going to love it. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Hi, thank you.
Well, thanks.
Happy to be here.
Well, thanks for joining me. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
First memory, that's a good one. I always loved reading. I have a memory actually of being in my bedroom and having my childhood bedroom and having all these books. And this was before I was able to read, but my parents read to me every night, and just thinking, oh my gosh, I just cannot wait until I can read these myself. Like, it just seemed like so frustrating that I couldn't. And then as soon as I was able to read, I loved it. And I think that for me, reading and writing always went hand in hand. But the thing that comes to mind when you ask that, a lot of it takes place in Rhode Island. And I remember being in third grade, so I must have been about 9. And I wrote, I think the assignment was to write about a place that we loved. And I wrote this piece called The Cove, which was about the sort of sand dune cove area that was across. You had to sort of take a dinghy to it from my house, and it was a little bit secluded. And I wrote about that, which I think, you know, I was thinking about that the other day, because it kind of was like, in a way, it almost made me feel like, oh, you know, this was the book I had in me all along. Like, this was the place that I wanted to write about, even from, you know, the age of 9.
Nice. You're at this childhood surrounded by books. I love that image of kind of the magic all around you, and you're just waiting to be old enough and big enough to tap into it. What were some of those stories that connected with you early on that maybe have lingered with you and stayed with you throughout life?
Let's see. I mean, You know, I actually had a lot of, my mom is Australian and my dad was English. So a lot of the books that I read growing up were Australian and English books. There was a series by an author named Enid Blyton, who wrote, she wrote a series called The Magic Faraway Tree. I don't know if that would be sort of something that would be familiar to an American audience or not. I should actually look her up. And they were sort of fantastical. It was this tree that you climbed up and then you sort of entered, went through a portal. And every time you climbed up, it would be a different world that you would access. So I loved that. I loved Roald Dahl, as I think most of us do. Certainly the BFG and Matilda were pretty formative as well.
When you mentioned Rhode Island and you mentioned that your parents are both non-Americans, your mom Australian, mm-hmm. your dad English. Where did the majority of your childhood take place?
Well, I grew up in Boston, but we did have this house in Rhode Island from the time I was about 5 years old. My parents were big sailors, so we spent every weekend sort of on the water sailing or at this house, and we actually did that year round. So certainly Boston is where I spent the majority of my childhood, but I think I always felt much more tied to Rhode Island.
Well, there's being Bostonian is a very specific feeling of place and belonging to a certain community and culture. There are certain parts of the country that are just very they're just special and singular, and that, you know, if you're from Boston, it means kind of these things. Having parents that are from two other different countries, did that have any bearing on your kind of sense of place growing up? You've got this connection to Rhode Island. You grow up mostly in Boston. Your parents are from two different places. A lot of times where we're from and those early influences become part of our storytelling nature. Do you feel like that has had a bearing on you and kind of all of the different influences that you had?
I do, but maybe not quite in the way you would expect. There's actually a part about this in the book where I write about Boston, because my parents moved there because my father went to Harvard Business School. And so that's why we settled there. And I don't think the plan was to stay, but they just ended up staying. But then when my father died, my mom sold our house and moved back to Sydney. And I actually was just in Boston this weekend for a book event, but it was probably only the second time I'd been back since we sold our house. And I think what strikes me most when I go there is actually how little ties I have to that city. And it actually makes me kind of sad. And I do think, like you said, I do think that has a lot to do with the fact that my parents were immigrants. When I go back and I see family friends and it feels, they just feel so much more tied and so much more rooted in that community than I think we ever were. And I think, you know, you asked if that kind of has an impact on my writing. I certainly think there's a way in which, you know, home and the idea of what home is and where we belong and maybe feeling when I was growing up, like I didn't quite belong in America, but also didn't belong in England or Australia. I do think that's it. Maybe a little bit of an undercurrent of the book, certainly.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You went to, excuse me. You went to Brown. You got your MFA from Columbia. Was writing something that you knew all along you were going to pursue?
I think yes and no. I mean, I think when I was at Brown, I was an English major, and I actually wrote an honors thesis my senior year on Virginia Woolf, on Mrs. Dalloway, Into the Lighthouse. And at that time in my life, I think I was thinking about possibly going into academia and becoming, getting a PhD in English literature. And then I, when I graduated, I moved to New York and I worked actually in an art gallery for a year and a half, and then at the Paris Review. And I, it kind of became increasingly clear to me that I felt like academia was going to be a little too sheltered or a little too claustrophobic maybe for what I wanted to do. And so when I had this, it was actually my boyfriend at the time was applying to Columbia's MFA program in fiction. And you know, when you're 23 and you kind of don't really know what exactly you should be doing. And I think, right. I was like, oh, that sounds like a neat idea. Like, maybe I'll apply too. And I did. And I got in. And then from that moment on, I knew very much so that writing was what I wanted to do. Creative writing.
Right. People have very, passionate opinions usually about MFA programs and creative writing especially. Some folks say that it just absolutely changed their life. It opened avenues for them that they never would have expected, and it was the perfect creative opportunity for them. And other folks find it stifling and maybe overbearing at places, and maybe their instructors were trying to form, you know, people just like them or whatever. But people usually come down one way or the other. What was the experience like for you?
I really enjoyed it. I'm very glad I did it. I think, you know, I'm someone who loves being in school. And I think that it was a real shock, those 2 years I described in New York when I wasn't in school. It felt, frankly, it just felt like I wasn't using my brain nearly as much as I wanted to be using my brain. And then when I went back to school, I remember just the first week being in a lecture course and with this really phenomenal lecturer, and I think he was talking about Bartleme. It doesn't even matter, but I was just sort of so happy to be there and so happy to be thinking in that way again. So I liked it for that reason. I think what they say at Columbia, and in my experience, this is really true, is that they don't really teach you anything that you couldn't figure out on your own, but they do condense it so that you're maybe coming to these discoveries faster than you would have. So I think, you know, I grew as a writer in 2 years, so much more than I could have on my own in 2 years. So I'm grateful for that. And I'm also grateful, I met a great community. I have some really close writer friends, and, you know, I got my agent because she was the agent of one of my friends. So just from a purely practical point of view, I also think it's really great for making connections.
Yeah. Well, and community and connections are something that get glossed over so much, but it's so important to have other people that you can bounce ideas off of, even just, you know, the encouragement of kind of the dark days of writing, you know, that other people are there with you. And, that's super important. And I feel like just gets ignored a lot, but that's vitally important to a writer.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Definitely. Cause it is such a, you know, so much of the time a really lonely
right.
occupation.
Yeah. And you need people to talk you down off the ledge every now and then. And, you know. Gather, tell me about Virginia Woolf, the Lighthouse specifically, but why this love and passion for Virginia Woolf?
Yeah, so I was first introduced to her work, at least in any kind of meaningful way, my junior year of college when I studied abroad at Oxford University. And I took a tutorial on her work there, and I just sort of immediately fell in love with her writing, and it felt more so than any writer I'd ever read, as if not only that she sort of understood me, but also that I understood her. It just really felt like this very strong connection. This actually takes place in the beginning of the book. My tutor there at Oxford was kind of like, you seem to have a really intuitive sense of Virginia Woolf. And he didn't mean it as a compliment, because I think he just kind of kept sort of acting as if we were friends and sort of saying, well, you know, these things that were completely unfounded in the text. but I, um, So, and then, as I said, I wrote this honors thesis on Mrs. Dalloway Into the Lighthouse the next year at Brown. But I actually, in the years after that, I kind of put her, even though To the Lighthouse was my favorite novel, I put it aside. And I stopped reading Wolfe because as a writer and someone who was sort of trying to find her own voice as a writer, I actually found her influence kind of debilitating. I found myself just it just felt like she was sort of a shadow in everything I was creating in a not useful way. And so it actually the book All the Lives We Ever Lived, I wrote an earlier manuscript that ultimately that was a memoir about my father, but that didn't have any Virginia Woolf component, and it didn't sell. And although it got a lot of positive feedback, and so it was when I was sort of thinking about how I could, because I hadn't really found the right way to tell my story yet, and my father's story yet, and so when I sat down to think, okay, well, you know, how do I tell this? It kind of occurred to me, really just like a lightning bolt, that all of the things that I had been writing about, things like grief, loss, marriage, failure, homecoming, all of these things were the theme of To the Lighthouse as well. And so when I put that together, that was really sort of like the big jump forward in terms of realizing how to tell the story.
That's a fascinating look at the journey. We all begin by wearing our influences on our sleeve to some extent, and we're a lot of times even kind of walking around in our hero shoes, and our writing reflects their deep influences on us. And I find it fascinating that you had to almost separate yourself from the great influence that Virginia Woolf had on you, but then come back to it because she was the ultimate vehicle that allowed you to tell this particular story. I find that fascinating. Were you cognizant of this kind of separation and rejoining of your influences along the way?
Certainly, no, not at the time, not at all. I think I was conscious I did make a conscious decision to put her aside. It's funny, it reminds me of a quote that Virginia Woolf had sort of a similar experience with Proust. And she said in a letter that, you know, every time she read Proust, this was to Roger Fry, you know, such is the intensification and saturation and that he procures that, you know, I feel like I must be able to write like that. And then I seize my pen and I can't write like that. So I think that, you know, this is something that, yeah, I think all writers go through with certain other writers. But no, when I came back to her, it really did feel like as I said, like a lightning bolt or an epiphany. Like I hadn't at all been aware of what was happening in terms of my relationship with her until I looked back on it. I actually just wrote an essay about it for Literary Hub. So yeah, it's been interesting to think about.
Well, the book is not only about your love of Virginia Woolf. Obviously, it's in the title, but I think more deeply, it's about the relationship of you and your dad. And you mentioned that you tried to tell that story earlier without the Virginia Woolf component, and it didn't work. But you found the way to tell it in this form. Tell us about your dad and why was it important to talk about this relationship?
Yeah, so he was English, as I said, and he was a very charismatic, vibrant, funny, sort of larger-than-life character. And he was a wonderful father, and I really sort of worshipped him when I was growing up. But he was also an alcoholic and big smoker, and he was diagnosed with cancer when I was 11. And then he actually had kidney cancer and then bladder cancer for the next 14 years. And then he died when I was 25. And I think what felt really important to me was to kind of capture his character and sort of paint a portrait of him almost. And while at the same time kind of just grappling with all these questions about the sort of contradictions of his character and why he was the way he was. And I think, and then a big part of it, as I see his story, is not just him, but also the absence of him and the kind of the hole that he left behind and the way that I grappled with that and the way that it sort of altered my relationship with my mother. So yeah, I think it was this kind of quest to understand him and understand who he had been and why he had been the way he was.
You know, father-child relationships are almost always complicated in weird ways that are not easily described a lot of times. And as a father, I am very conscious of that fact as I go through life with my children and thinking back on the relationship of me and my father and not wanting to repeat mistakes and not, you know, wanting to be different yet finding the things that I love and appreciate. It's a very tough, road to travel, sometimes. And you invariably look back and realize that you have fallen into the same patterns as the ones that came before you. And that maybe you understand your father a little more as you're forced to make decisions and things like that. And, it's the older you get and the more you look back at your parents, the more complicated it becomes. And, Virginia Woolf is not necessarily the lens that I would first imagine, to trying to, unravel or get to an understanding, of my parents. At one point did you realize that she was going to help you tell this story?
I think once I sort of realized the connection between the themes that I was writing about and the themes of To the Lighthouse, it seemed, To the Lighthouse is a novel about a sort of larger than life mother, Mrs. Ramsey, who and her children are sort of head over heels in love with her, and the everything sort of revolves around her, and the father can't quite compete, and is sort of, a tyrannical figure compared to Mrs. Ramsey. And then, she dies midway through the book. And then the rest of the book is kind of about the family and the friends, grappling with her absence. So, and To the Lighthouse is very autobiographical. Virginia Woolf lost her mother when she was 13. It was a real sort of enormous break in her life, that really the sort of literal and figurative end to her childhood. So obviously the parallels between my life and To the Lighthouse and Woolf's life are not at all exact, but I think that the way in which both stories, or all those stories, are about the death of this kind of central maternal or paternal figure was the way in which I felt like I would be able to kind of better see my father. I mean, one of the things though that has been really illuminating about writing this book is that my goal when I started was to kind of get to know my father better. But the fact is that in writing about him and, I interviewed a lot of his friends and family members, and I learned quite a bit of, I learned one major secret and a few kind of just littler secrets here and there that made my father actually recede a little bit. I think, that's something that, maybe it sounds obvious, but if you set out to paint Virginia Woolf has this line about in her autobiography where she's writing about her father, and she says, "I'm going to try and describe him not as he was to me, but to the world at large." And, you know, and I think what I didn't really realize is that who my father was to me and who he was to the world at large were not one and the same. Those two men were different. And by trying to understand who he was to the world at large, that would actually make him feel further away and less knowable. And so that was a really sort of revelatory thing for me.
Yeah. Well, and by writing memoir, which this book is really kind of a mixture of memoir and biography and then this intersection of, you know, a book that you dearly love and how those things all intertwine. When you're writing memoir, invariably you are telling the story from your point of view, from this is my experience with this man, and this is how I see him. And then, like you said, you're bringing in other perspectives as well. But invariably there's a point where you become, a character in the book does it become difficult to portray yourself in the book and to trust your memories and to expose yourself, in the ways that are not always comfortable and to just kind of abandon yourself to the story?
You know, I get so concerned about what I'm exposing about people who did not choose to write the story, namely my mother and father, because I think it's really unfair in a certain sense to be subject of a memoir when you did not ask to be. I really don't worry at all about what I'm exposing about myself, because I kind of feel like that's what I took on in wanting to write this book. I do worry more about what I'm exposing about my family and the sort of ethical implications of that. I'll also say, because you said in terms of what you remember, I actually have a terrible, terrible memory, but I've kept a diary since I was 11. And actually most of the scenes, in the book, I first wrote about at the time. I feel pretty, obviously everything is subjective, and it's just, you know, it's my sense of the scene is going to be very different from, say, my mother's or my father's, but I do feel confident that at least I'm portraying it the way that that I made sense of it, even at the moment that it was happening.
Sure. A lot of us that keep diaries or journals or whatever, most of the time, I would think these are just ways for us to capture a moment, capture how we felt on a particular day. Almost a self-therapy sometimes, and just venting emotions that maybe we don't feel like we could share with anyone else at the moment. If you've ever written a project like this, and I've done some things sort of like this, having those recollections to look back on are priceless. And if you could have had the presence of mind in the beginning to know later in life, I will want to talk about this again, so let me make sure to capture this. Because you're a longtime journaler and diary keeper, do those thoughts ever occur to you as you're writing things down that, you know, this may be important one day to something else, or is it just something for you that just happens to be convenient later?
Certainly when I was growing up, I didn't think about it in those terms at all. I think, for instance, the middle part of the book is, takes place largely in the hospital when my father is dying. And I was writing all the time during those actual months as it was happening. And I think I was aware, that I would want them as a writer, but also just as, as a daughter. I think I was very aware of wanting to record everything and write everything. I didn't want to lose any moment of it. I think probably when I first started writing, it was more just, as you said, like almost like therapy or just sort of a source of comfort to write. But I think I think later, certainly kind of when I knew my father was dying, yeah, it was the, it was this attempt to preserve and to hold on, both for myself and for you know, whatever I was going to write in the future.
Right. Catherine, when people are finished with the book, and the book All the Lives We Ever Lived, Seeking Solace in Virginia Woolf, it's out everywhere now. There's links to it in the show notes. When people are finished with the book, when they get to the end, they close that back cover, and they're sitting there and ruminating on the story that they've just been told, and the glimpse into your life and your relationship with your father and all of this stuff. When we're sitting there with the book, what do you hope we take away from it?
Oh, that's a tough question. Because I think of it as being about so much. There's another Virginia Woolf quote where when she was talking about what To the Lighthouse was going to be about, she said it's going to be about mother and father and childhood and life and death and all the usual things I try to throw in. I sort of feel like that, I want them to take all the usual things. But I think more specifically, I would want them to more have a feeling of kind of a this is going to be kind of incoherent, but a really grand feeling of how sad life is, and also how uplifting and how hard to make sense of, and how we strive to make sense of it anyway. And it's kind of like the way when I finish, a novel by Woolf or To the Lighthouse, it's not one message that I'm getting, right? It's more just this kind of sense of life and feeling a little bit closer to understanding what life is. And I think, I don't know if that makes any sense, but I think that's what I'm sort of hoping that the reader will take from my book as well.
What we realize is that life is grand, and it's grand in the mountain peaks, and it's grand in the valleys. And when we look back, we realize that the good times, the bad times, all of that has shaped us in some way. And it's only when we can look back and relive those moments that we can fully appreciate those. And hopefully by walking through the story with you, we can appreciate the things around us, more as well. I love the book, Catherine. I love what you're doing. The book's available everywhere. Now we're going to send everybody to get it. Is there a place where people can follow you online if they're just learning about you and want to learn more about you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I have a website, catherinesmythe.com. That kind of has links to everything, all the reviews, all the interviews, my bio, things like that. And I also, maintain a pretty constant Instagram presence, and that's also Catherine Smythe. One word.
Nice. Excellent. We'll send everybody to follow you there. Are you working on anything now, Catherine?
Well, I've been working on a lot of personal essays, some of which have come out and some of which are coming out, and some of which are tangentially related to the book and other things that are new. But I do have an idea for a novel, which is percolating.
Nice.
And then I'll leave it at that.
We'll be on the watch for it. Catherine, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Missing Wings by Andrea Luman. Born with an ability the Viladi people of Madar believe make her one of the first to be blessed by God, Katrina's destiny unravels when her father is poisoned and her mother steals her into the human world to hide among those who hate her kind. In a near-fatal attempt to return home, Katrina is stripped of her wings. The poison meant to kill her father leaves him in a degenerative state. When her eldest brother discovers she has survived, he orders her to stay in hiding. She must wait, concealed in the human world, until the danger of their father's uncontrolled rages is contained. Grown and adapted to the human world, Katrina encounters one of her kind. The promise of home and the first love leads her into a situation capable of starting war among the Viladi. Will a human upbringing, mistakes, and the loss of her abilities bar her from reclaiming her heritage? Will unraveling the mystery of her mother's betrayal lead her family into an even greater danger? Missing Wings by Andrea Luman. The Locust, books 1-3 by Ralph Kern. The Complete Locust series, an epic tale of mystery, survival, exploration, intrigue, and war. The cruise ship MS Atlantica is lost on these strange and uncharted seas, where even the compass shows the sun rising to the west. Atlantica's passengers and crew must do what it takes to survive. In Unfathomed, Atlantica arrives in a strange new world. Unable to locate land with no way to contact home, they must find new allies, fend off relentless enemies, and discover the horrifying truth behind the Locust. The future of humanity will be decided as the fleet confronts the architect of the Locust. Not everyone will survive the desperate final battle. The Locust box set contains all three action-packed novels in this best-selling science fiction thriller series, Unfathomed, Expedition, and Osiris. Acclaimed for great characters, thrilling action, technical accuracy, and a compelling sense of mystery. Buy it today! The Complete Locust series by Ralph Kern.